Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Bob Berman is considered one of America's top astronomy writers. He is currently a columnist for Astronomy Magazine and the science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. His latest book is Zoom, How Everything Moves from Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees. In Zoom, Berman explores how motion shapes every aspect of the universe, spanning astronomy, geology, biology, meteorology, and the history of science itself. It's a great pleasure to welcome Bob Berman to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you here. What brought you to this idea of movement and what makes things move?
Well, I think it was originally astronomy, since, of course, that's my field, and there's nothing that doesn't move in space. And all the motions from meteors to planets to eclipses. And over the years, I'd come across odd things like the fact that the moon moves its own width in an hour. It's the only object in the known universe that does it, shifts its width. And I realized, well, that's why eclipses take an hour to go from the beginning to when the sun is fully covered. But then there are all these things on Earth that also have these strange, weird, amazing, interesting motions. So finally got my publisher to let me do a book on them and not just stick with astronomy.
Is that a hard sell when you go to the publisher and say, I want to veer off course here, but it does come back to my field here?
No, they loved this from the beginning. Okay. They thought it was great, a great idea.
When you decided to do it, how much of it is investigation? How much of it is what you actually know? How much of it is putting it into the context that you want to put it into?
Great question. I'd say that I did not know most of what's in the book. That came from research. I had no idea how fast bacteria swim, how fast dust particles settle. I didn't know that it takes them an hour to settle an inch at night when you leave a room alone. You know, so a lot of the stuff was fun for me because it was gee whiz kind of information. On the other hand, Joe, some of it was from a trip that I'd already taken down to the equator in Quito, Ecuador, where the Earth moves at its fastest and where they have demonstrations of water swirling down drains in opposite directions, supposedly. So some of it was from experiences that I already had that I couldn't wait to put into the book.
I'm going to ask this question, please do not take any offense from this question. But I thought it was interesting in the sense that I'm on my couch, I'm curled up with my wife and my dog, and I turned to my wife and I said, did you know that bees travel at about 7 miles an hour? And my wife responded, no, I did not know that. Pause. I don't know why I need to know that. And I thought that was interesting because it's one of those things, because the book is filled with stuff, but I found it fascinating and have held on to it now, you know, since I've read the book, of all these little facts of things that, yeah, you didn't know, but maybe somehow this is important to us.
Well, I thought so. I mean, us geeky kind of people like facts and that who knows when we'll use them in life.
Right.
But it really comes down to relating things to ourselves, like when it comes to insects or mice, how fast do they move relative to us? And I don't think I ever really realized that mice only travel 8 miles an hour top speed. They look a lot faster, and that it's due to how many body lengths those little critters can do per second. And that's what really determines whether we see something as fast or not. A jumbo jet coming in for a landing can actually seem very slow when it's coming in because it takes a whole second to move its whole length of 230 feet, whereas a sailfish can move 10 body lengths per second, so it looks super fast to us. And mice shift their entire body length, many body lengths per second, so they seem fast, even though we can actually outjog them.
Now, how do you figure that out? So for you as a scientist, is that math? How do you figure that out?
Well, fortunately, I did not have to actually run after mice and measure their speeds myself. Or
that sounds like it takes away the fun, doesn't it?
But I love the fact that cats can go 30 miles an hour, mice only 8. So it's really not a fair race between Tom and Jerry. If they were in a straightaway and the little rodents, their advantage is zigzagging and doing things like that. So and when it came to insects, you know, if you're taking a walk in the country and you've got buzzing mosquitoes or flies, it's crossed my mind. Maybe it's crossed other people's mind. Can you outrun them if you really tried? And then I realized that mosquitoes, yes, anyone can outrun a mosquito because they're only a few miles an hour. But you can, and a bee, that becomes a little closer. They only go 8 miles an hour. So you could, if you could really set up a good clip. But flies, a lot tougher. And horse flies, no way. So those creatures from hell, they're going to stick after you no matter how fast you run.
And you point out in the book, I believe, that mosquitoes, A, don't last very long. And if you're not where they live, then you're safe.
Exactly. They have a range of only half a mile to a mile. So if you have a property that you can really get rid of the water sources, like we've started looking at the old plastic stuff and old swing sets that we had and tarps and that used to cover the firewood. And if you can keep standing water from accumulating on your property and somehow control everything within a mile from you, no, you won't get mosquitoes.
What do we know and you address this in the book early on, but what do we know about movement? How much of it was ancient, and how much of it have we learned relatively recently?
It's been a pretty steady clip, Joe. What I tried to do in Zoom was go to the earliest questions, like, why does the wind blow? As you know, there are facets of nature that are steady, predictable, you know, the sun and the moon and the tides, and they come in cycles, which the ancients knew about. But the wind was its own case. Sometimes on a clear day, it would blow. Sometimes on clear days, it would be calm. Sometimes, you know, and the opposite would be true. So it was the most capricious and unpredictable. And it took until Torricelli, about 400 years ago, to be the first person to tell us why the wind blows. And we didn't even have concepts like a weather front. It seems so common now, you know, that there's a big masses of warm air and cold air, and where they meet, that's where the winds are strongest, that's where the weather and the storms come up. But it wasn't until World War I, appropriately enough, that the word front was coined to the concept of these warring globs of air. So I'd say it was most of what we've learned has been the last 100 or 150 years.
And as you point out in the book, some of it is obviously it is nature, and some of it is man-made when we talk about movement.
Yeah, I figured I had to put in a little man-made stuff. I pretty much avoided that, Joe, because I wanted to do everything from germs to blood to body
right.
to intestinal fluids and the stuff that moves by itself. That's the real focus.
It comes in more in comparison.
Right. And the one chapter we talked a little bit about human bodies and how we got to propel ourselves quickly. I didn't know that the biggest change was really between 1790 and 1830. Before that, most people traveled by carriages, where it would take you about 7 days to go from, let's say, New York to Boston. And it was torture by almost every account because you'd be hot or cold and there'd be insects attracted by the horses themselves. And it was really uncomfortable. And in just that 40-year period, people who were kids around 1790, 1800 were astonished by the 1830s, 1840s to see the huge changes that had come about in transportation, first brought about by the introduction of roads that were raised up, that were created. It was a new system. We'd put three layers of stones, the roughest on the bottom, the middle layer stones above them, and then the finest stones compacted on the top with drainage districts on the side. And this reduced lurching. And these were called highways because they were raised up above the rest of the countryside. And this is what really let speed increase and become more comfortable. And then after that, of course, the riverboats and railways. They were always called railways, that never railroads. In fact, roads fell into dilapidation in the 19th century because people were taking just boats and railways. And it wasn't until the infatuation with the car, that's a whole human lifetime later, that roads started to be improved again. And it was funny that at first cars were regarded as environmental saviors.
Mm.
This is what would save us from the loud din of horseshoe clip-clops on cobblestones and the smell of horse poop and the flies they attracted. And it was awful. And all of that was going to be done away with by this environmental wonder, the car, that was going to make everything so much cleaner and better.
You talk in the book so much about nature, and as we mentioned, so much about how things move and why things move. And then you get into, I think, just a fascinating conversation and discussion about reliability. How reliable is nature? So when we talk about these issues, what is the reliability of knowing what it's actually going to do? Because ultimately, that can change. The variable there is huge.
Yeah, some of the things are predictable. As we travel around the sun, for example, the planet to our left, Venus goes 3.5 miles per second faster than us. You can always count on it. It has a very reliable cruise control kind of speed. Planet on our right, Mars, the next planet outward, is 3.5 miles per second slower. When we look into the night sky, there's the meteors, and some hit us head on and always come in at a particular speed. Larger meteors are always slowed down by air resistance and only hit rooftops. And believe it or not, a roof is hit every year and a half or 2 years here in North America alone by a meteor. They only come in at about 250 miles an hour because they've been slowed by the atmosphere. And so they reliably come through the roof, maybe through one additional floor, and then lodge themselves in a bedroom or the living room. This has happened over and over again. And it's never much faster than that. It's never much slower than that. So some of the things are indeed reliable. Other areas like our digestion, which can move about an hour to take a foot of distance in our intestines. Some people have ideas about how fast they want their own stuff to move through their intestines. I can't believe I'm going here with this conversation.
No, go ahead. It was on my list. It's a very interesting part of the book, so I was going to get to it.
So, there's generally a reliability about things. Birds always travel at about the same speed. I mean, they can, at least. Hummingbirds and geese, they all fly at the same speed of 20 or 30 miles an hour. That was something I sure didn't know before. I mean, a bird can fly slower or faster, but they all like to fly at about that same speed.
And blizzards being in the title, what about weather? Because we don't think of weather as being reliable, but when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, is it reliable?
In the grand scheme of things, yes. And among the things I learned was I had no idea that at the heart of 80% of all snowflakes, there is a germ, a living germ, sitting there, shivering there, freezing there. And that since snowflakes need to have like a little nuclei to start them growing, a single atom cannot freeze. So you're going to have groups of atoms and molecules that freeze into the familiar hexagonal pattern of a snowflake. But it's a germ that serves as the nucleus around which a snowflake starts. So when we see a snowstorm, this is a great thing to tell your favorite a hypochondriac or germaphobe, you know, like, you know how we stick out our tongues or we did when we were kids to catch snowflakes, you know, well, maybe we won't do that so much now that we know there's a germ in the middle of almost every one of them.
So two questions about that. One, why only 80%? It would seem to me that it would have to be universal. It would have to be 100%.
Well, I only know one country whose scientists have done an actual study of this. This was France, And they found that 80%, because there are other substances such as kaolin, clay, little bits of clay, little tiny particles of dust in the air that can also serve to form snowflakes. So I guess it doesn't have to be germs. Mm-hmm. I assume that other countries are just as sanitary or unsanitary. Maybe I'm editing myself and not mentioning particular Central American countries where I've been, but I assume that there's not a higher ratio in some countries than others, but I don't know.
Bob Ehrman is our guest. The name of the new book is Zoom, How Everything Moves from Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees. Is the makeup, is that germ a consistent germ, or is it different, such as we hear of acid rain, of what the content of that rain is from something that is going into the atmosphere? Is that where it's coming from?
I mean, how do the germs, or why are they even flying
through the air in the
first place? Are they strep? Are they staph? What kind of germs are we talking about? Well,
yes.
I knew that sooner or later you'd ask me a question that I don't know the answer to, and I don't.
So we don't know how it gets there, but we do know that it's germs. So, and we don't know. So this was going to be my next question of how much are we responsible for some of this? We as a species being responsible for the movement of these things, bringing us to the ultimate question of climate change and global warming, of whether we are screwing things up.
Well, again, this would be a question that I'm just going to make up the answer to. I think we don't have to have any guilt about snowstorms.
All right.
And the germs that are at the heart of each snowstorm. I think that's probably always been the case, that the bacteria have always been there. Some of the events, like the molasses flood of Boston, a rather famous event, that, of course, we were responsible for. But in most of Zoom, we talk about natural items, and we kind of leave the human involvement to a minimum. It comes in here and there, Joe, but by and large, this is stuff that's going to happen whether we're around or not.
So let's talk about the writing and the writing process. One of the things that you are praised for, rightfully so, I believe, is being able to take a subject like atoms and galaxies and be able to describe it to a lay audience and for us to understand this. What are the challenges in being able to do that and to put it in language that we understand and to give us examples to take these huge fields of scientific thought and bring them down to a very agreeable level for the average reader?
Without sounding immodest, if I have a talent, it's reading an audience. So when I give lectures, I can tell from the stunned, blank look on their faces that I have left them behind and I better back up and head in a different direction. So I have a sense of what may resonate. So I don't want to just keep going on and on and on. I don't want to throw number after number, just data and figures. Humor is very important. If I can put a smile on anyone's face just from the way I've phrased a sentence or relayed an incident, that's a mark of success. I try to be playful and a little poetic in the writing, and I think people will, I think that's the most important thing. And if I've been clear, I think I can always do as a writer. I think I'm good with making things clear. Much more of a challenge to make it funny and fun, enjoyable, maybe a little poetic at the same time. That's the real challenge. And I think the ultimate answer is how about 20 drafts of the book before before it's finished?
So the opposite end of the spectrum, the bad side of the spectrum, is dumbing something down. So you don't want to do that. So it assumes that there is some balancing to be able to have the clear scientific thought still intact.
Right. And there are some chapters in particular, for example, as you well know, in Zoom, one chapter talks about quantum phenomena that are infinitely fast. And
right.
that you get entangled particles or EPR correlations, and what happens to one is known by the other, even if it's halfway across the universe, instantaneously, in real time. It doesn't even require light speed transmission from one place to the other. So once you get into quantum stuff, it can become very heady and hard to understand. And so I think I dumb it down for myself to start out off with. If I'm not to put a lot of math and formulae equations in it, which I don't, then I have to understand it first. That's the first thing, and fully grasp it. And then I feel I can share it with my readers.
Educationally, are we good at understanding math and science? Many people have a fear of it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there's it's discouraging. Some people do, and I don't know if this has changed, Joe, from the way things were 30 years ago or 50 years ago. You know, not to sound elitist, but there's a curve, a bell-shaped curve, not just of intelligence, but of interests. And there are people who are not particularly interested in nature. Math, I try to avoid as much as possible. I mean, of course, there's going to be some math in this, but it can be off-putting to a lot of people, as right. you know. And a lot of people have trouble with basic science. Recently, there have been some letters to a newspaper in my area of people who are not understanding studies about cell phone use. Now, we have a whole chapter about the stuff that goes through our bodies, invisible things. Microwaves and cosmic rays, and some of it is harmful, some of it is absolutely benevolent, good for you, healthful. But a lot of people have trouble if there's a nuance, if there's something like ultraviolet in the summertime, if you're by the beach, is this bad for you? Well, if you get a serious sunburn, it can give you a greater chance of developing a skin cancer, and 8,000 people a year die from melanoma. So should we be avoiding the sun? People on the Vitamin D Council say we're avoiding the sun too much because UV also generates the natural vitamin D in our bodies, which is the greatest anti-cancer agent ever known. So here's a nuance. Too much UV is bad. Too little UV is also bad. So you can't just say good or bad in those cases. And a lot of it is like that.
It seems as if much of what you write about comes from your curiosity, which hopefully answers our curiosity. Why do the clouds stay in the sky? If you hit a line drive, why does it curve to the right? I mean, those are the questions that you ask yourself and you share with us as an audience. Curiosity plays a huge role in this.
It does, because it's fascinating. This has always fascinated me. When we've heard about the Coriolis effect, where things curve to the right, thanks to Earth's rotation, the next question is, okay, but how much to one degree? If Albert Pujol does hit a home run and it's heading towards the foul post, how much is it curving to the right? A foot? A yard, an inch? Turns out it's more like an inch. So occasionally a ball will go foul when it would have been a home run had it not been for the fact that the earth is turning underneath that baseball stadium. So degree is, to me, very important, too. Your car, when you go down a perfectly level road, will start pulling to the right thanks to the curvature of the earth, thanks to the Coriolis effect. And I'm sure a lot of unnecessary wheel alignments have been done by people who don't realize this, that this is just like something that cars have to do, pull to the left if you're in the southern hemisphere. So the degree is really important. I mean, how much of this? You know, people say sneezes are the most violent act. You sneeze faster than the speed of sound. Well, is that true? How fast does a sneeze really go? And it's not enough to put it into a number. It's relative to other body motions. What's the fastest any part of our body ever moves? It's probably the fingertips of a pitcher throwing their best fastball. I think the best is 105 miles an hour. Well, if the ball is leaving at that speed, then his fingertips are also going at that speed. That's probably the best we can do.
The thing I'd always been told is that if you sneeze and it's violent, that if your eyes didn't close, they'd pop out. Is that true?
That's funny. No, I've never, in doing the research for that, I'd never come across that one. There was
seriously. Oh, I've heard that over. We were talking about this just the other day here in the office.
Well, it is a violent event that affects much of the body. Sphincter closes down. The back can be thrown out of whack. There's a lot of stuff happening during a sneeze, and there have been questions as to why, and why does the body do it? Why do we close our eyes? And it's probably, yes, to protect ourselves from the germs that are coming from the sneeze, but that's guesswork.
Well, the name of the book is Zoom, How Everything Moves from Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees. It is published by Little Brown and Company. Bob Berman, it's always a great pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Joe, a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.